Happy Tuesday, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the Help for HD News Channel. This is your host, Melissa Biliardi. Even though this is a news channel program tonight, please feel free to call in to numbers 310-982-4227 or the toll-free 877-497-4103. If you have questions or comments, please call us. We'd love to hear from you. When you call in, press 1. We'll cue you into the show. You can ask your question or make a comment. Please tell all your colleagues, friends, and family about Help for HD Radio, and do click follow on our show page to get email reminders of upcoming episodes. Thank you, more than 73,000 listeners, for tuning in each time here. Tonight, Terry Temkin is here from UC Davis Health System. She's here to talk about PreCell, which is a pre-cellular therapy observational study in early Huntington's disease. Terry is the nurse practitioner, study coordinator, and co-director of the HDSA Center of Excellence at the UC Davis Medical Center. She comes to us with a Bachelor of Science in Nursing, Adult Nursing Practitioner, and Master of Science in Nursing, extensive experience with clinical studies and trials, and she has a very long list of certifications and prestigious work history, and we are so honored to have her back on the show. She is our go-to gal for PreCell. We hope you've had a chance to read the article on the Huntington's Post as well. You can go there at www.thehuntingtonspost.org/ all in caps PreCell, and you can download the flyer there as well. But we are going to talk to Terry now. How are you? Welcome back to the show.
Melissa, thank you so much, and hello to all the listeners this evening. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you guys about this exciting project that we're getting off the ground.
This is exciting. Do you realize the last time you were with us was on April 4th of 2011?
Oh, my goodness. Time flies.
Yeah, time flies. So, Terry, tell us, what is PreCell? What is the PreCell study?
Well, UC Davis, it was actually on a year ago, July 26th, the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, and I know that you've had representatives from that state organization, which is in California. I think you had Ellen Feigl on the show one time.
Yes.
So CIRM is an agency here in California that was actually enacted by California voters. California voters wanted to fund continued research in cellular therapies, and that was for all diseases. So last summer, UC Davis has gotten a few grants in prior years for other things, and about 4 years ago, Dr. Nolte, who's our stem cell researcher here at UC Davis, received a grant to do some science, some basic science work in cellular therapy and Huntington's disease. And then January of 2012, we submitted an application. So we is Dr. Nolte and myself, Dr. Nolte's clinical manager, Geralyn Annette, and then Dr. Wheelock, who's actually the principal investigator of PreCell. We submitted what was called a disease team grant to CIRM. In other words, we said to CIRM, we've advanced this science, and we're now ready to proceed to wanting to construct a clinical trial. So we put it in January of that year and had 7/10 months of waiting. And then on July 26th, with the help, and I'll get to this a little bit, with the help of many, many people in the Huntington's community, CIRM said, we're going to fund that study. So
yes.
PreCell, I know, isn't that exciting? That's a huge, it was huge for a lot of reasons. Not just because, oh my gosh, here's something we can tangibly do that may help the Huntington's community, but it was huge that in California, you have to realize every major institution and every big school of medicine, everybody's vying for CIRM dollars. Everybody is. People in heart disease, people in HIV, people in, you know, cancer, all the big guys, they all want CIRM money too, and they get funded as well. And here's Huntington's disease that, as you guys very well know, most people don't know that much about, and many people don't care about because it isn't in their family. And raising money for research dollars in Huntington's disease has been hard because we're talking about very few people. And here we were at the top of the heap. And not only did we were awarded this disease team grant with this cycle of funding, our grant scored number one out of 20 grants in the state. It was just totally amazing. And I think
that's just amazing.
It's totally amazing. There were a lot of things to do with that. Of course, Dr. Nolte is doing amazing science, so that played into it. And you guys know that Dr. Wheelock and I have a very, you know, active Center of Excellence program here. And those were two key components. So we have patients. We have a lot of experience in conducting clinical trials. We wrote a trial that was, you know, just amazing. And then the science. But I'll be honest with you guys, and a shout out to, you know, all the wonderful families who contributed to it. I'm absolutely convinced. I've been in this business 15 years with the Huntington's community. I'm absolutely convinced that it was families who showed up at the public meetings, who served on committees with CIRM, brought visibility to these people who otherwise wouldn't know what Huntington's is. They brought an important component of visibility to Huntington's disease that I think helped us get this award. Because otherwise you have to ask yourself, these big, all these scientists, why would they care? They cared because the families who advocated on behalf of us made them care. And we owe them an enormous debt of gratitude.
Yes, we do. Once we see the faces and look into their eyes, you can't say no. You just can't, you know.
Yeah. There's an awful lot to that. You know, something made Huntington's disease rise to the top of the pile. And,
wow.
You know, they hear from a lot of scientists, you know, all the scientists and, you know, clinical people and stuff. You know, we don't have much standing because everybody toots their own horn, right?
Yeah.
So what was the denominator that made a difference? And I think it was the families.
I
so
totally
thank
agree
you.
With you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Woo-hoo! Woo-hoo! To the families. Right on.
That's amazing. Well, this is historical for Huntington's disease, too, because this is the first ever cellular therapy that's coming into fruition, right?
Well, actually, let me clarify that. It's historical for sure. There's no question about that. There have been some cellular therapy trials in Huntington's disease specifically in other places. Most notably, the French have been doing programs with cellular therapy trials, and actually one of their most active investigators, Dr. Catherine Anne-Catherine Bachoud-Lévy, she's a French neurologist and neuropsychologist, agreed to be an advisor on our project. So we went out to the international community in Huntington's disease, and we asked the best people to help advise us and help construct this project, which they were more than happy to sign on. So what is first about this is we're not the first person to do cell therapy in Huntington's, but we are the first people to do cell therapy with mesenchymal stem cells specifically.
Mm-hmm.
So as you guys know, the MSC cells that Dr. Nolte has been researching with and improving upon and genetically engineering all these years are adult stem cells. These are not embryonic stem cells. These are adult stem cells that are derived from bone marrow. And so what's first about this project is we're the first ones anywhere in the world to use these specific types of cells. And there's a lot of reasons why we picked this. As you guys know, just because it's important to you know, clarify this, this initial, you know, project that we're doing right now, pre-cell, and then it'll launch into HD cell, this initial project is not the cure. People just need to understand this is not the cure, but this is the foundation and the building block of what we hope will be the cure. So these mesenchymal stem cells, in and of themselves, they have amazing properties. They help restore neurons. They secrete factors that help to keep the neurons from dying out, and that's why we think they're great candidates for using in Huntington's disease. But there's nothing about their property that will stop or that will cleave off the expanded part of the Huntington's protein that causes Huntington's disease. But these cells can be genetically engineered to do that. And that's actually not this project, but that's the next project that Dr. Nolte's lab is actually working on, and we hope to bring to the next project, you know, the next, you know, funding round. So it's in the works to do that, but it's important people understand that this initial one we hope will that we'll see that will determine it safe. So we have to, we have to be very careful about this. This is a safety study. And so the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration that regulates anything that happens to anybody, right, will only let us claim safety in a study like this. Dr. Wheelock and I have designed it that hopefully we can see some improvement, but we can't promise that, and we don't know that going into it. And then this is the foundation, the building block for then launching into a cellular therapy that that will be a cure one day.
So this is an observational study only right now.
So pre-cell, yeah, let me explain why we had to do this in two different studies, all right?
Okay.
So, you know, when I talked about our international collaborators, France has done some, there's a group in Toronto that did a little bit, and there's a group in Florida. So all these other groups, there aren't very many of them, but all the other groups that have done some cellular therapy all said unequivocally, and so did our advisors, because remember, when we put this grant in, it was reviewed by Huntington specialists all over the world who gave us, who basically said, do this and don't do that, okay? So our advisors, as well as our reviewers, every one of them unequivocally said, you have to have an observational period before you put this in. So there are two reasons why pre-cell, which is the thing that's been IRB approved right now, pre-cell is the observational portion of this. And the reason why that's a critical step is because we have to establish before putting in a therapy that has not been done, you know, using these cells in Huntington's disease into an area that these cells have never been put before. Now, these mesenchymal stem cells have been in many other body parts in humans, and they have amazing safety data. There's never been cancers that have been associated with this. They're just great cells, but they've never been put in the brain. So the FDA treats it like a brand new entity. So we start at ground zero, right? And they're doing that to protect people, by the way. They're not doing it to make it harder for us or make it harder for Huntington's families. They're doing it to protect people. Yeah. Well, you know, you don't want you don't want charlatans giving people snake oil, all right? So there's a reason, you know, that they do that. It's hard sometimes to go at their pace, but it's what you got to do to play the game. So or I should say to be in the arena. It's not playing a game, it's in the arena. So the pre-cell is the observational portion. So part of it is part of the reason of doing this observational portion is everyone knows that Huntington's disease changes over the course of time, right? People's symptoms vary over the course of time. So people will initially come into pre-cell and get, and they'll, we'll establish a baseline for them. So pre-cell will be a minimum of 12 months and a maximum of 18 months. When people enroll and come into the study, there's four to five scheduled visits, depending if you're a 12-month or an 18-month or and so what we'll be doing is looking at data about how, what their Huntington's is like and then how it changes over the course of time. And the reason it's important to establish people as their baseline is because if things go good on the other side after the cellular therapy or things don't go good because with science you don't know, right? No matter what happens on the other side after they get the therapy, we know what they looked like before. So it's critical that we have that step, and that's why this is being treated as two studies. One is we need this observational period so we know what people look like. The other reason is because Dr. Nolte's lab is still working on the safety data, so we still have some mice work and we have some primate work that has to happen before the FDA, you know, reviews our whole application, right? So she's doing that right now, and we've constructed this so that we're doing it in tandem. In other words, what we didn't want to do is wait on this project and wait, okay, well, maybe she gets that stuff done in a year and a half, and then we have to start with an observational period after that. We didn't want to make it that long. So we've done this specifically concurrently to put prospective people into prospective participants into this observational study, which is IRB approved, and we can talk about it and recruit for it now, and you guys have seen, you know, some of the print material. To establish the baseline, allow for Dr. Nolte to continue with her science, and then have that culminate within the next 12 to 18 months in the approval from the FDA to then actually start the cellular implantation phase of that. And we're going to be calling that study HD Cell. So that's why it's two projects.
Very smart to do it that way, too.
Well,
so that no time is lost, you know?
We didn't want to lose time.
Precious, you know. Fantastic. Okay, so then this is an observational study. It's a base, kind of a baseline for the HD.
Yeah. So what we have to. So here's one of the other things too. As you guys know, every study has what's called criteria. There's what's called inclusion criteria and exclusion criteria. So in addition, you know, remember, what the FDA wants most is not only to demonstrate safety, but the other is that we keep subjects, we call them subjects, not patients here, we call them subjects, that we keep subjects safe. In other words, we minimize the risk to them to the amount that we most feasibly, practically can, that we don't take undue risks, all right? So every study has what we call eligibility criteria. And that means there are certain sets of information that they have to meet to get into the trial. And then if there are other things on the exclusion, if there are anything on the exclusionary list that pertains to them, they wouldn't be in the study. So for one of the, for an instance, this is designed to look at people with early stage. So one of the exclusion criteria for this study is pre-symptomatic. So people with who know that they have a gene test and they have the gene expansion, if they haven't been diagnosed yet with actual symptoms of Huntington's disease, then this is not the study for them. There are other studies for that, but they wouldn't be eligible for this one. So this is looking for people who have early stage, and one of the reasons we had to specify early stage is as people get later stage, we hope to eventually have a therapy that will help people in any stage. But we designed it specifically for early stage because that's the safest time to do something like this. As this Huntington's disease progresses, the brain changes are such that we felt like we'd be taking more undue risks. Now, it's very possible that the FDA may come to us when we finally get down to our face-to-face with them and say, I'm sorry, you have to do people who are dying. They sometimes do that. But I don't think they're going to in this instance, and we hope that they're not. But this has been planned and designed for early stage. Another, for instance, about criteria is people with a gene expansion of less than 38, so like if they're in that gray zone of 36, 37, they wouldn't be eligible. It has to be 38 and above. And again, there are scientific reasons for making those decisions. So people, when they call me, one of my jobs in addition to getting this going is to help people, is to look to see if people meet the inclusion criteria or don't meet the inclusion criteria, and then we go from there. So lots of people just think, oh, if I volunteer, they'll take me. And actually, I love that philosophy, and I love people who do that. But we have to follow the criteria, and that is
right.
We have other studies we can put people in. So I don't want to discourage people from, asking those questions.
Right. James just put up the PDF download of the pre-cell flyer. Is that going to be expanded upon once you start enrolling for this observational study as far as criteria and exclusions and that kind of thing? Or is this the flyer on the flyer?
The flyer was kind of minimal. One of the reasons we kind of, kept that generic right now was because this was, we wanted on a single sheet of paper.
Right.
So if you go into all the inclusion-exclusion criteria, then you might run into multiple. And we figured this is meant as just a handout that you can hand out at support groups, you can send on the Internet. And if people want more specific information I pulled up the wrong one. Hang on here. If folks want more specific information about the inclusion-exclusion criteria, then I can they should just call me.
Yeah, and that information is on the flyer. Terry Tempkin's phone number and email address and that kind of thing. So yeah,
give
you're
me a few days to get back to people, okay?
Lots of phone calls. Yeah, and emails.
No, no, no. We're excited. Happy to do that. And it's you know, one of the things that we have to be really careful about is, again, you know, we're regulated from many, many different directions. And it's okay. It's okay because at the end of the day or the beginning of the day, I have to sit across from a potential subject or in Dr. Wheelock, we have to sit across from people and give them our assurance that we're trying to protect them. And so
right.
I'm actually okay with all of these regulations because it's, you know, I know it slows things down, but it's the right thing to do to make sure that people treat people with respect, that when people come into research, they understand it's voluntary and that they're doing it for altruistic reasons. So, you know, it's okay. So anything the point I was trying to get to you guys is that anything that we send out to the public, you know, like that flyer that you guys attached to your blog, thank you very much for doing that,
right. It
all has to be approved by what's called the Institutional Review Board. So every research organization, including universities like where I work at UC Davis, we have an Institutional Review Board that we cannot conduct any research at all, any study, no matter what it is, without a committee of people made up of our peers that review the study to make sure we're adhering to all the federal and state guidelines, right? So
right. It's
called an IRB. That's the vernacular. So you'll see a lot of things thrown around about IRB, and that's what it is. It's an institutional review board. And they not only do we have to have everything approved by them, but they review us annually to make sure that we're doing everything we said we were going to do and that we're doing it right. Again, it's a good safety check. So we don't send anything out to the public that is not IRB approved. In other words, like, you know, so I have consent, you know, the consent form and this flyer and a couple of PowerPoint presentations that the IRB said, yes, you can use those in public forums. It's okay to use that. But other things are not. And so the things that aren't approved by the IRB to send out, I won't send out. And why it's just a good idea to call. Because I can talk, you know. Yeah, I can talk.
You want to follow the rules.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's just living within that framework, you guys. And I hate to say, I don't want to discourage anybody about it. I'm trying to promote the knowledge or educate people that it's actually a good thing to be safe.
Oh, of course. Safety first, right? Safety first, always. And if it's slower, I'm sorry. Safety first.
Well, you know, Melissa, to the wonderful listeners there, we're not the only ones who have to abide by this rule. Everybody does. Everybody
does. I know.
And, you know, there's a history, and I won't go into this because I know that's not what this conversation is about, but there is a history in the United States where people were subjects of research that never knew they were, and horrible things happened to them. And there subsequently were many regulations to make sure that that never again happens in our country, that people were experimented on without their knowledge and without their consent. And so there's a history. And you know what? It's the right thing to do. Well, it's the only way. The only way and the right way. So.
And a lot of people were injured and hurt during those.
Yes, they were.
Horrible.
They absolutely were. And we're not going to be we're definitely not in that camp. And we'd never be in that camp. So, but that's why you have all these regulations, because there was a time in our history when that did happen.
Horrific, terrible things that happened. So we want to do things ethically, safely, and if it's slow, so be it, because that's the most important thing.
Well, we were kind of making, you know, one of the things that's so heartening to me, because you guys know that I've been, you know, working in the clinic with Dr. Wheelock for 15 years now. One of the things that's so heartening to me, Melissa, is that we're now actually embarking on a project that has a real hope for families with Huntington's.
Yeah.
You know, we've done fish oil, we've done, you know, we're doing creatine, everybody knows, you know, hopefully maybe it makes a little difference, but nobody had any faith that that was really going to turn the tide against Huntington's. And we're so hopeful that this project is the beginning steps to really make a difference for families. That's what we really want to do.
Of course.
I never thought when I started 15 years ago, when I was fortunate enough to be recruited by Dr. Wheelock and Judy Robertson, I never, ever thought I never, ever thought that we'd be doing this. Never had a dream that we'd be doing something as significant as this. And here we are.
Again, historical moments.
Yep, historical moments with the partnership of all the families. Because that's what it's ultimately for. It's for the families.
Yep. Okay, let's talk about the actual study procedures. What happened?
Oh, there's going to be a lot.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks for asking that. You guys, so as you guys know, Huntington's disease itself can have changes in thinking, you know, cognitive changes and changes in mood, and then the motor changes. So we've designed measures to, we've been doing these in trials for, you know, 15 years, so we're really good at this. And we use some of these same tools and stuff in our clinic. So we'll be doing lots of motor tests. We'll be doing lots of thinking tests, you know, the red, blue, green. If any of you guys have been in a study before, you'll recognize that. We'll be doing mood evaluation. We're so fortunate because we've got this great clinic of full of experts. So Dr. Wheelock will be doing the project. I'll be doing the project. Lisa Kerr, who's our social worker here, will be doing the companion. So everybody who comes into the study has to have a companion, and there are some companion forms they'll have to consent to come into study too. And so Lisa will be working with the families. And then Dr. Scherer, Lauren Scherer, who's the psychiatrist who works in our clinic, is going to be doing the psychiatric evaluations. And Dr. Sarah Farias, who's a neuropsychologist here, who's been working with us on the PREDICT study, she's going to be doing all the cognitive studies. So, Amanda is our research coordinator. Yeah. So Amanda is one of our biggest jobs is getting everybody in the same place at the same time, tricky. Yeah, which is tricky. So evaluations are going to be in depth and they're going to be intense. And so, in addition to the routine Huntington stuff, we'll be doing brain imaging, and one of those is to because we're working with Dr. Elizabeth Allward, who is at Children's Hospital in Seattle, and she is probably the world's specialist in brain imaging and Huntington's. Well, there's other specialists too, but she's a really good. She's like up there with the three or four who are specialists in this. Yeah, she's working with us. She's an advisor on this project. I told you everybody wanted to sign on to this because they're so excited about it.
Now, contrast the brain imaging?
No, we're not going to be doing contrast. We'll be doing brain imaging, but we're doing what's called volumetric measuring. So we've been doing this in the PREDICT study for 12 years in PREDICT. And so that's what Dr. Allward is the world's expert in, is in brain imaging and Huntington's disease. So we'll be doing imaging to look to see the changes in the brain that happen. Because remember, when we finally do get to the study where we can do the cells, we're putting those cells directly into the brain. So we got to know what it looks like beforehand and how it's changing before we put a product in there. Another reason why this is two studies. So, and then we'll be doing a lot of blood work. You know, we'll be monitoring people for safety. So we're checking their blood chemistry and their blood counts and things like that to make sure that they're healthy and it's safe for them to be in this study. And then we'll be doing spinal taps. And the reason for doing a spinal tap, that's our most invasive procedure. But we're real good at it here. We've done them, lots of them before. And, you know, they're safe to do. The reason to do some of the blood and the spinal fluid is we're contributing that to Dr. Steve Hirsch, and many of you guys know his name. Mm-hmm. He runs the Huntington's lab at Massachusetts General Hospital. He's been an expert in biomarkers, what are called biomarkers in Huntington's disease. And the reason getting biomarker information is so critical, Dr. Hirsch is looking at what therapies or are there therapies that actually that you can predict from these biomarkers that that will be helpful and tell you that there's signs of improvement. In other words, you know, one of the things we'll be looking at is visually, do people look any different on the other end? But the other is, too, is to help his research advance the knowledge of what biomarkers or measures in blood and CSF that can give us information about the efficacy of a treatment, whether that's a drug treatment or whether that's a cellular treatment. So part of this study, too, is we're working with Dr. Hirsch in his lab.
Wow. Are you connected with all the databases then? With
no.
Study?
Oh, good question, Melissa. That's a great question. Now, because we've been part of that study group, if we needed information from those other studies, because remember, you know, here at UC Davis, we've been pretty much doing a lot of this for quite a while, we'd probably have access, but we built our own database, and the reason, you just have to do that. And we hired an outside company. They're called Clinical Research Organizations, CROs. We hired a great team through Clinipace. They've been amazing. So they've set up our electronic database. Now, we'll be able to merge information from other studies if we get permission to do that. And if at the at some point that becomes important to do, we have the capability from the database we're building. We definitely have that capability. But right now, remember, each individual patient who comes into Precell is their own control. So right now, we don't need a lot of outside information. We're establishing them as their own control.
Right. But when it comes to output, so, for example, Dr. Hirsch information, can that be input into his?
Absolutely.
Okay.
He'll be able to use it for the current work that he's doing with other projects, as well as what it helps us with our project. That was one
this
of the reasons
fantastic.
To try to collaborate, was that we're contributing information now into that big pool of Huntington's research data that, you know, we're just doing it from a novel cell therapy type, but we'll absolutely be able to contribute to the bigger effort. And have already built in the systems to do so.
Okay, so these testing measures will be done every 6 months, or?
Oh, good question. So we have to do what's called a screening visit, and the screening visit is one of the longest because we do the brain scan, we do all the blood work. We don't do a lumbar puncture at that one. We do all those assessments. You have to do the informed consent, which is the very first thing. You have to sign, you know, the consent form that says, yes, you're willing to do this, and that's like signing a home mortgage. I always make a joke about it. It's an important step, and it's the very first step, by the way.
Yeah.
And all the assessments and stuff. So we anticipate that to be a 6 to 7 hour visit by itself. And it may be because there's so many people involved and there's so much to do, it may be that we can't get the brain scan on the same day. That very well may happen. And so it may be that visit has to happen over a couple of days. But we're building in that flexibility to, you know, try to do it one day if we can. If we can't, you know, we'll build it over 2 days or possibly 3 days, and that's just the way it is. And then people don't come back again. So if they pass all the baseline things, and I don't mean pass like pass in school, but if their blood work all comes back okay and there's nothing that concerns us that would put them at risk, if they're, you know, everything on their brain scan is good, we have to kind of analyze all that data. We have to put it all together after we've had that big, long visit. Then they come back, and it looks like it's safe to put them in. Then they come back for a baseline visit, and the baseline visit will be within 30 days of the screening visit. So those two visits are pretty close together. But then people don't come back for 6 months. So they come back at a 6-month time point, then they'll come back at a 12-month time point. So the people who come in first will probably have a third visit at 18 months as we work our way towards FDA approval. People who come in later might only have the 12-month time period. We've built it to be either or so that we can stage the movement of people from pre-cell into the next, you know, the next project.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think James, we're starting to get questions in the chat room.
Okay,
and so
all right, good.
So, James, did you have a question from one of our...
Yes. First, we love you, Terry.
Oh, love you guys too.
This is a three-part question. The community member did not give me permission to mention their name, so bear with me.
Oh,
do you have to live in California? If you don't live in California, can you participate? If so, is there any assistance to get us to this study?
Oh, you guys, thank you for asking that, because that's an important thing, and it's real important. First of all, you do not have to be a California resident. So remember, back in the beginning of the conversation, I said this money came from CIRM. CIRM is funded by, so this project is essentially funded by taxpayers. And let me tell you, every 4 months, Dr. Wheelock, Geraldine, and Dr. Nolte and I, we work for like 3 or 4 weeks at a time to write what's called a progress report. We owe them a progress report quarterly. And so we have to be uber accountable for taxpayers' dollars, right? So the restrictions on this are actually that as the investigator, as the people doing the study, you have to be in California. So that's why it only goes to California institutions, California researchers. But participants can come from anywhere. And I'll tell you why I'm leading into this. Participants can come from anywhere. Anybody, there's no geographic restriction. You can come from New York, you can come from Virginia, we personally don't have a geographic restriction, but you have to make all the visits, and all the visits have to happen here. Here's the sad part of it. There is not reimbursement for travel, and I'll tell you why. But there's somebody planted an idea, and I'll share that with you. And the reason why there isn't travel in this particular budget, it was taxpayers' dollars, and our budget was so high just to do it. The surgeries alone, by the time we get to the surgeries alone are $150,000 per subject. So it doesn't cost the subject anything. You know, when you're here getting this blood work and you're here doing all these tests and you meet all these specialists, that doesn't cost you a thing. We don't bill your insurance. We don't bill you. So it costs a lot of money to do that. And like I said, we estimated $150,000 per subject, and there just absolutely was no room to build into the budget travel money. And as sad as that makes us, you know, you could see somebody with the, you know, 5 visits for just this initial pre-sell, you know, you could run up $5,000-$7,000 per person for airplane flights for their companion, right, hotel rooms, meals, travel, you know, we couldn't do it because it's taxpayers' dollars. It's not private dollars. But here was one of the things, and I know that will be a disincentive to people, and we're really sorry. We're just so sorry. I wish it could be differently. But I talked with, I'm not going to name them because they didn't give me permission to, but I talked with a group of people from another state, not in California, who do fundraising in Huntington's disease, and they are looking at doing some fundraisers to actually fund somebody to participate in this. And so there might be ways of people creatively looking at other ways of, you know, supporting those travel dollars. Again, once you're here and we're doing all those assessments and stuff, it doesn't cost you. In HD cell, you know, that's approved and whatever, there are several visits in that. There'll be, I think, 11. Because people come back at week one, people come back at week two, people come back at month one, you know, month two, month three, month six. So that's a pretty ambitious schedule.
Wow.
Interesting. Wow. Okay, well,
see why it took us 2 years to write this grant.
Yes.
Serious.
Well, that's a good way to answer the question, because I was thinking, because it was funded by the taxpayers, that it would only be available to California.
Mm-mm. No,
but
it's not restricted. So we can screen and enroll people from any place, but they just have to get here.
And if we can do some fundraising, that might help.
Uh huh. Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah. It isn't for us to determine. You know, we won't have any. We won't have any kind of determination or anything on how people or how they fund that. That's entirely their purview and their, how they do that is up to them. We, of course, can't fundraise for people because then we have conflicts of interest. So we can't do that. But the simple answer to that, which, you know, got a little more complicated, but the simple answer to that is people do not have to be a California resident to participate in this.
Yay!
Yeah.
For those of
you
in other areas, that's good news. Okay, so are there risks to the observational study?
That's another really good question. Oh, my goodness. Thank you, you guys. you're hitting on all the things that are so
it's
important.
It's on your flyer.
Yeah. There are some minimal risks, okay?
Okay.
You know, so, and here's how we've outlined them in the consent form. And anybody wants to email me, because on this flyer, my email's there too. Email's going to be quicker than voicemail, by the way. So if you're thinking about contacting me, shoot me the email, because then I can attach these forms for you. I can just attach them to the email and send them back to you, which, you know, it saves us a step when we're doing that on the telephone. So the risks, which we outline in the consent form, you have to tell people what any potential risk could be. First of all, which a lot of people don't think about, there could be some emotional risks to this. And the emotional risk is sometimes it's hard to get looked at. You know, when you have Huntington's disease and you know you're going to get under the microscope here and we've got all these surveys and questions and tests, that can be emotionally challenging. So we encourage people, if they're feeling that way, to talk to us about that. We've never had anybody have a breakdown or have any problems like that. But every once in a while, in some of our other studies, people have withdrawn because they found it kind of difficult to do that. It was difficult to do the tests and difficult to think, oh, my gosh, I thought I was doing better than that, and find out, in fact, that they weren't. So that's not a that has to be taken into consideration. We have to inform people that there's the risk of, you know, bleeding or infection with blood draws. That's never happened to us to date in 15 years. There's a little bit of a risk of a headache after the lumbar puncture, but we have a whole protocol in place of how to care for them. We're doing this out at our research site where we have nurses, and you guys all know that I'm a nurse practitioner too. So we have skilled nurses who have a whole protocol of how to care for you after the lumbar puncture to avoid that headache, and then, you know, what to do if you do get a headache, and, you know, we can give you some medication. So there's a small little risk of that. And then some people can get claustrophobic because of the brain scan. So we're going to try to do people without sedation, but if somebody needs a little bit of sedation, we might consider that so that they don't get claustrophobic. So those are pretty much, you know, the emotional things with the blood draw, with the lumbar puncture, and then the brain scan, pretty much the only risks associated with this observational study.
Yeah, I do know that some people have phobias about claustrophobia, of course.
Oh, yeah.
One, and then, phobia of needles. I don't know what that's called. Needle phobias.
Needle phobia? Yeah, actually, you know, when people know that, that's a good point. When people know that. Yeah, when people know that about themselves, it's best to tell us, because then what we do, first of all, if the phobia is so bad you won't get your blood drawn, you can't come in. That's okay, that's the bottom line. No exceptions. That's about it. But if people are kind of skittish about it, but, you know, they're willing to have a test, we actually lay them down. So out at our research site, we have these little chairs that you sit in. It's like if you go in and get your blood drawn at you know, a lab, any kind of lab, and you sit in those little chairs and then put your arm out. We actually, if somebody's skittish, we'll lay them down because we don't want them fainting on us.
Good idea. You don't want them on the floor.
We got that. Yeah. We got that covered.
Our James, our producer James, is very needle phobic.
Oh, yeah.
Melissa. Be nice.
Yeah. I'm just thinking.
I was just telling her that as you guys are talking about this, I'm feeling lightheaded.
Yeah, you know, that happens. I have to tell you, you know, James, that actually happens to people, and there's a theory for that some people are very, we call it vasovagal sensitive. Some people are very vasovagal sensitive, and when they either see that needle go in or they feel that needle go in, their vagus nerve gets stimulated, and they get what's called an autonomic response.
Oh, yeah.
And their blood vessels kind of constrict a little, and then they get lightheaded because they're not getting enough blood to their brain, and that's what causes them to faint. So there actually is a medical reason for that. Yeah,
yeah, you just brought 2009 back, because that's when I got my test done. Yeah. And all I remember is waking up with a big knot on my head.
Not good. Yeah. Well, we've got a bed. No. We've got a bed to lay people out. So,
poor James. Another thing that I think we need to mention, and I don't know, is Katie in there, and if she wants to say anything? We're talking about the fact that, you know, this is science.
Hello.
And science. There she is. Hey, Katie, you know, you and I were talking, well, we were talking in the screening room a little bit about the fact that this is science and science is not fast.
Yeah.
Do you want to explain what you were talking about?
Yeah, I think that we all, that it's so important for science, you know, for science for the future generations and for our generation as well, that I don't get discouraged when I think of time and stuff with science, because I think that, you know, for future generations, this has to happen. A pathway has to start. And without the UC Davis team starting this stem cell pathway, it may never come. So
right.
I think the UC Davis stem cell, UC Davis clinic and lab, with all my heart, for even bringing stem cell therapy as a thought to Huntington's disease. And also, we thank you for further generations. And we do understand that it is science, and we understand science. We understand that it may not be the cure for Huntington's. It may not work. It may. We'll never know unless we try. So thank you to UC Davis for trying for us.
Katie, that's so sweet. You know, thank you guys, because it's been an extraordinary partnership. And I kid you not, every single one of us on the team, we all recognize the important role that families, in not only just in bringing this project to fruition, all the advocacy, but over the years, look at what you've taught us. Look at what you've shared with us. Look at the stories that you've shared with us that gave us the motivation and the courage, and do every single day. Every single day I come in here, I come in for you guys. You know, I don't come in because I work on this, you know, big, huge project. This is exciting, and I'm happy to do it. I come in because of the families, because we really, our team here, Dr. Nolte, Geralyn, you know, Dr. Wheelock and myself, we want to make a difference, and we want to make a difference because you made us care. So we care, and we're working as hard as we possibly can, you guys.
Yeah. Well, we thank you. We thank you,
yeah.
All of us.
No.
I know you
group
guys.
Hug. Group hug.
Yeah,
we
know.
It's amazing that Huntington's disease, even that, you know, Dr. Nolte and Dr. Wheelock and Geralyn and Terry, I mean, I'm aware of the countless hours, and I think the Huntington's community owes you all just the most thank you for spending tireless nights and hours on the grant application and getting this.
Oh,
so,
you guys.
It's huge. So thank you.
No,
so
guys,
I have a
that
question.
Is so sweet. Thank you.
I have a question, Terry.
Mm-hmm.
Have you figured out how many hours have gone into this project so far?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, you guys, I can't. Oh, no. I haven't, and I'm kind of scared to. I'll let you know, back in 2010 was when we actually started writing the grant. Do you know that every Thursday night, Dr. Nolte, Dr. Wheelock, myself, and Geralyn, we'd lock ourselves every Thursday starting at 4 o'clock. We'd lock ourselves over in Dr. Nolte's lab in a room, and we'd put things up on a big PowerPoint screen. We actually still do that. That's how we write our progress reports and all of our other things that continue to make decisions. We meet every Thursday at 4. You know, if somebody's on vacation, we may do it by teleconference or whatever, but every Thursday at 4 is our meeting, and we've been meeting that way since, like, early 2010. We put the, you know, the grant, the big grant, and now we put the project and we put the, you know, reports and all this kind of stuff on a big PowerPoint in the room, and we sit there and line by line we write this. And some nights we were done at 6, and other nights we were done at 10, and some nights we went to midnight on Thursday nights. And yeah, I know, it's a good thing we like each other and get along well.
that always helps
a lot, and it helps an awful lot, because if anybody was like, you know, every once in a, you know, sometimes I get, you know, testy or prickly or whatever, we all get that, we have bad days or whatever, but everybody else gets it, and we're all so tolerant. And you know, here's the thing that binds us, even in our worst moments nobody wants to disappoint you guys. That's bottom line. And even if we didn't get along, we don't want to disappoint you. And, you know, we've had challenges. I'll tell you, you know, during the course, I'll be, you know, I know I'm telling a lot of people this stuff, but during the course of last year and trying to get things launched, I had cancer. And it was scary. It was awfully scary. And I'm good now and I'm fine now and everything. But, you know, it's just what you do. It was knowing that I've got this work to finish that was part of my motivation for, you know, come and pass that. So, you know what, things aren't perfect. And things, you guys know this. The honey, you guys know this. You guys totally know this. That life isn't perfect. Yeah, life isn't perfect.
Yeah.
But you get up every single day and do your best. That's what you do. That's what I, you know, talk to patients about when I see folks in clinic. And you get up every day and do your best. And that's what we're doing. We're trying to get up every day and do our best. And like I said, it wouldn't have happened without you all. So,
well,
yeah.
We need some clones of you.
No.
Yeah,
there's lots of great people, you guys. There honestly is. You know, there's lots of great people all over the country who care
there
about
are.
Huntington's
Absolutely.
Disease.
Okay.
I just happen to be the one on the telephone, I mean, on the telephone, the radio today. But there are so many wonderful people who care just as much as us. And, who
and everyone has been on my
too.
Show.
Yeah, that's
and we want more. We want more.
We just got another Facebook message in saying that please let everyone know at UC Davis that we love you. Big L-O-V-E.
Oh, you guys, thank you so much. We love you too. We that's so sweet of you to say that. I know.
We know. You wouldn't be doing what
you're
doing.
The whole Facebook community, everyone in our social media network, they knew that this was coming. So there is hope. There is hope.
There's hope. And it's, you guys, we're making progress. We're making progress. Making history and making progress.
So obviously, what are the benefits to participating in pre-cell?
So the benefit for, that's actually a good question. The benefit, the overarching comment to that is the benefit is, and this is the only thing the IRB will allow us to say. Actually, Dr. Wheelock and I, we went back and forth with them, you know, a lot on the exact wording of this. The benefit for participating is contributing to the body of knowledge. All right, that's what they are saying that we can claim. And when we get to the cellular study, the only thing they're going to let us claim is the same thing, that we can prove that this is safe. But I want people to know that we've designed this study to look for improvement. We've designed it to look for that. But we just can't claim it from a regulatory standpoint. You guys have to understand, we cannot market this study to people to say, you will have improvement. We can't say that, and we're not going to say that. Mm-hmm. But we'll be looking for it. You see, hopefully you guys understand the distinction. So what we can say to people is coming into pre-cell is contributing to the body of knowledge. The other thing is you don't come into HD cell unless you're in pre-cell.
Right.
It's the bottom line. Because we have to be able, we won't be taking people off the street into HD cell because we have to establish that baseline. We have to have that observation period for a minimum of a year beforehand. But the IRB is very careful. We can't coerce people. We can't say to people, you can't come in unless blah, blah, blah. So you won't see that in our print material either, but it's an important distinction that the claim we can say is that you're contributing to the body of knowledge. And then the people from pre-cell who meet the criteria for HD cell will move on.
Now, is that a classification of clinical trial?
Sorry, Melissa, say that again?
Would that be a specific classification of a clinical trial, like a closed clinical trial?
Yeah, once we get to HD cell, once we get approval to do that, we get the IND, granted to us from the federal government, and we have that whole thing, that actually will be a phase one clinical
IND.
Trial. Yeah, the IND is what's called an investigational new drug. All the chatter I was saying about the FDA approval, that's actually what they give you. They grant you an investigational new drug license that says, we've given you permission to do this. So that's what we're working on in tandem with pre-cell. That's what Dr. Noltz's lab is working on, putting all the information necessary together to get that application.
Fantastic.
Now, Melissa, we have a couple of comments.
Okay.
Well, Mary Robertson, she basically wants to know how many people will be allowed to stay at your house.
Oh,
many people can sleep? How many people can sleep in your bed for this trial?
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. That's funny. I'll have to defer that with my live-in boyfriend, you guys.
And who's cooking?
Right. You're serious.
And who's cooking? Not me.
Yeah. Well, we have someone else asking how many people will be allowed for pre-sell, and then how many of those will be allowed to participate in the HD study.
Oh, I love you guys. So we're recruiting up to 40 people into pre-sell. So up to 40. And the reason we said up to 40 is, you know, we just had to make a provision for it's better with the IRB, remember our review board, it's better with them to, like, say up to something than to say exactly, you know, okay, well, we're going to put in 36. Because then if you go over, you go under, then they want to know about it. So, up to 40, and that 40 cap was decided for a couple of reasons. One is we were funded for enough money to do cell implantation for 26 people. So we anticipate that out of that 40, we'll have the 26 needed to progress on to the next, you know, to the next study. And it was interesting when we first designed this, you know, Dr. Wheelock and I thought, oh, okay, well, you know, we need 26, we'll go 30. You're thinking, but actually things happen, things change. You guys in the Huntington's, you know, community know that every day is not the same. And so if someone has a major psychiatric problem or, say, they get in a car accident or something like that, then they've been in pre-sale, they'll now be ineligible. So we had to make provisions for that, and every one of our advisors said to us, you got to recruit more than 26 people. So we did.
Makes sense. That definitely makes sense.
Yeah, and the, you know, again, we're hoping the FDA has the right to come back to us when we finally, you know, get this IND. They have the right to come back to say, okay, we think you can only do 3 persons per, you know, per arm, and so they may cap us at 15. That we have no idea, but our proposal is to do 26. The FDA may have another thought.
Mm-hmm.
But that will
be something that's going to come down from FDA at some point in time.
Yeah. But our plan.
This is so exciting.
Yeah. It is exciting, huh?
I think we had another question, but let me see who it is. Okay. The question is, well, I'm not sure if it's a question. She's saying, so approximately 18 months for pre-sale, then what steps for 26 surgical?
Yeah. What we've proposed in that, and remember, this isn't set in stone yet, but so the 12 to 18 months in pre-sale, and then if somebody, we're talking theoretically here, you guys, somebody moves to the HD cell, then they'll be scheduled for the surgical procedure, and there are 11 visits after that within the span of a year. So you're coming back, the people in HD cell are coming back pretty frequently. And one of the reasons is, you know, first of all, there's all the post-surgical monitoring that we'd have to do in the first, you know, couple of weeks. And this actually is not, the surgery that we're proposing for this is not, it's actually the same surgery that they use to do what's called deep brain stimulation in Parkinson's disease.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a surgeon here who is one of the country's best surgeons at this specific procedure. And instead of leaving an electrode in like they do for the DBS system, you actually implant the cells and take the catheter out. So this is a safe procedure. It's been done for many, many years in a different application, not for cell therapy, but in a different application. So we don't have to make the surgery up or anything. Mm-hmm. It's standard procedure. Our team here has been doing it, and every other major hospital in the country does this type of therapy for Parkinson's disease,
right,
with the deep brain stimulator. So it's not hocus pocus, you guys.
legitimate. We know that.
Well, no. It's important because you hear brain surgery and you go, oh, my goodness, what are these people talking about?
Yeah.
So I kind of diverted here. So then after the surgery, then they get out of the hospital, then those visits are pretty close together because we got to watch people. We've got to watch to see what happens. So there'll be more brain scans, twice as many brain scans. There'll be a few more, about the same amount of lumbar punctures. There'll be blood draws, you know, and then all those clinical assessments, because we are looking to see if something good happens or something bad happens.
Right.
Yeah.
Good stuff. It's exciting. So if anyone has questions or needs to talk to Terry, maybe sign up. Please call her at 916-734-6278, or they can email Terry Temkin at teresa.temkin@ucdmc.ucdavis.edu. It's on the flyer, so please feel free to download the flyer and call, email, and let's get everybody going on this so that we can get some science done.
Yes. I have updated the app, so everything that we're talking about tonight is already on the app, the downloadable documents on the app, and also the Huntington's Post.
And speaking of the app, James, we have close to 15,000 active app users.
Yes.
Which is amazing.
It's an amazing, amazing thing. I try to, you know, look at the stats as often as possible. The only stats that obviously take time to come in is the iTunes, because we all know Apple takes their time. So, I cannot wait. We're just a couple hundred users shy of 15,000 active users. Now, defining what that means is people might have the actual app on their phone, but the report that I get is when they're active, meaning when they're actually using it. So at one given time, close to 15,000 people are actually using it. So the number is obviously higher than that. We just don't have a way to gauge that just yet.
That's amazing, James. And how long have we had this app up now?
Not even 3 years. Not even.
2 years.
We started out very slow.
Yeah.
We pushed it a little bit because we wanted to, you know, gauge the community's response and get as many individuals on there as possible. So if you're, you know, part of the HD community, just please check out the mobile app. And I'm downloaded. It's free, and you can actually listen to live shows and, of course, podcasts that are recorded afterwards.
And, James, how can they get the app?
You can go to wehaveaface.org/application with a lowercase a, or just go to helpforhdinternational.org. Basically, it's been shared all over Facebook, so if you need anything, contact me. And or Melissa on Facebook.
Yep, awesome. Terry, was there anything else that we maybe left out or something else that you wish to tell our community about?
Well, you know what, I actually want to thank you, James, and Katie, specifically Melissa, because you do such an important service. I just, you know, being able to get information to people and people being able to have a place where they can connect and hear about things is what you do is just amazing to me. And we're so grateful that you do this on behalf of the community.
Welcome.
And again, my heartfelt thanks to everybody in the Huntington's community for every little thing that they do to contribute to advancing research for Huntington and just, you know, being part of our Huntington's community. We're really, really grateful to you all.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Melissa and James, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about this. It was amazing. I appreciate
You're
it so
welcome.
Much.
And
You're
if everyone
so welcome.
Could tell everybody they know about it, we could have a little bit more coverage.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All righty. Any more questions in the chat room, James?
I want to say yes, but the scroller has just been going crazy.
Oh,
I think we do actually. We do have one. Will there be possibility of rejection as in organ transplant? Is that something that we can discuss now, or is that way too early?
No, that's actually a really good question, because that's a generic question about the stem cells themselves. That's a great question. No, rejection is not an issue with this type of stem cell, and that's why we like them. They they shield themselves. I'm taking the verbiage right. I've hung around Dr. Nolte long enough now to know this language. The nice thing about these mesenchymal stem cells is that they shield themselves from the immune system. So when we put them in people, we do not have to give people anti-rejection drugs. Isn't that great?
That is wonderful.
It's terrific. It's awesome. I know. That's a barrier for some of the other types of cells, but one of the reasons why Dr. Nolte has loved these cells so much. And, you know, remember again, this first project is not the cure. We're not there yet. This is the building block. It's the building block, and but these cells have just amazing properties that we're anxious to see what's going to happen.
And we can't wait to hear how the trial goes, the observational study goes, and I hope you'll keep us updated and all that. We'll have you come back on and
be happy
tell
to
us, tell us your progress.
And we'll try to get a good price on some huge tents and pillows and blankets, you know.
Yeah, that's funny. That's great.
We'll just put up a soup kitchen out there.
That's right.
We'll have the HD community run the soup kitchen.
There you
That's
go.
That's right. There you
the
go.
Local, yeah, the local support group. Hey, you guys, don't carry this idea on. You're going to give people ideas.
Oh, golly. Yeah. Well, listen.
Great show, guys. Thank you.
Yeah, awesome show.
Thank
we had
you guys.
Fantastic attendance in the chat room. So, everybody, thank you for, typing in your questions and comments, and thanks for listening, everyone. I think we'll go ahead and conclude the show for tonight. And thank you, Terry, so much for spending this time with us. It was awesome. And thank you, everyone, again, for tuning in. Please contact me at helpforhdinternational.org. Find us on Facebook, Help for HD International. Come back and listen to the on-demand episodes. And you can download any episode you wish to share with your colleagues, friends, and family. Get the free app on the road, Help for HD, at Help for HD International, and we have a face.org. Also available on the app is the original mobile connection to education, resources, and information about JHD and HD. Everyone have a great night, and we'll talk to you next week. Have a good night.
Good night.
Night.
Bye, everybody.